Okay, so a warm welcome again to everybody who's joining us, whether in reality or virtually. It's quite lovely to have this opportunity to acknowledge 25 years of Abhay Giri, honoring our elders, honoring our teachers. It's a it's taken a fair bit of organization for Ajahn Yaniko. He was the conceived of the idea to do it. Of course, that's one of the problems of having ideas, is you actually have to follow through on them. and it's great. It's wonderful when there is that picking up on something but of course it was many other people helping, particularly Kathy has been sort of the Zoom maestro and helping us. But then there's also a variety of monks been helping to figure out how to make our live streaming, Zoom, YouTube actually function. It seems to have come together quite wonderfully. So that's there's an added added element of surprise when one has technology involved as well. So that's been a challenge, and people have risen to the challenge. So it's interesting is that it seems to have been fairly easy to complicate things, and it's more difficult to simplify it, which is a great metaphor for life. It's what we all do as human beings, and one has to make a conscious effort to simplify. Anyway, it has resulted in us having this gathering and to be able to reflect on 25 years of Abhay Giri. And that sense of giving a certain acknowledgement and appreciation, honor, respect to all the people who have brought it to this point, which is, it's a huge number of people, really. Abhay Giri started as an idea. It's 25 years of Abhay Giri. The idea started quite a few years before that, of a group of Bay Area people who had met Ajahn Sumedho, who had realized that there were monasteries in Thai forest tradition, Ajahn Chah in particular. Several of those people also went out to Thailand to see the roots of the tradition. Many people went to England when there was nothing, before there was anything here. And then, of course, Lobosomero used to come to America every year because when his parents were still alive, then he would come back, and then he would meet people, and many people got inspired and wanted to have a monastery. So that's it wasn't the actual physical monastery didn't really begin till 1996, June 1st, 1996, and of all of those, let's say, the people who came on June 1st, 1996, to open the monastery. Did Debbie come that day?
She wasn't
here that day. Okay, so you were the only person who's here now, right? Yeah. So the night before June 1st, May 31st, there's actually Visakha Puja, and Ajahn Amaro, they held a Visakha Puja at 10 Arbor Street, which was a house of Mark Lieberman, and his front room was like a shrine room. That was the meditation hall for Sangapala Foundation. And meetings took place there regularly, and kind of energy started to slowly gather from that point. And of course, Ajahn Amaro went back and forth for quite a few years. Ajahn Sumedho delegated Ajahn Amaro to be the point person, or the person to take responsibility for if and when anything happened. So he'd come and spend 6 weeks, 3 months each year for quite a few years. And finally, Sangapala Foundation actually made a kind of a request to the Sangha in England, because the Sangha in England was quite hesitant to commit to establishing anything in America. And they had their hands full in England, and they had a couple branch monasteries in, one in Italy, one in Switzerland, also New Zealand, that they were taking responsibility for. And it was like, you know, we've got enough, and we don't want to spread ourselves too thin. So there was a lot of hesitancy and reserve to establish anything new in America, knowing that it would take energy, actual human beings. Should have people who are trained to come here, and so that they were very slow to commit to start anything. So then they with that kind of happening, then the Sangapala Foundation, they had. It was quite a lot of effort to bring into being, rent a place for a short period of time, make it all happen, and then dismantle it again, only to try to bring it all together again the next year. So they actually made a request to the Sangha in England, 1995. It was the year before it was established, and it was at that meeting when you can sort of see how the devas or the forces of goodness are working behind the scenes somehow, because it was that meeting they gave permission to. The Sangha in England gave permission for Sanghapala to go ahead to try to find something that they could commit to putting energy and resources into that would be more permanent without having the Sangha to commit to sending anybody. And then it was shortly after that meeting, I mean, like within 24 hours, that the Sangha had given permission, and then Ajahn Sumedho received the offering from Master Hua for the 125 acres here in Redwood Valley to establish a monastery. So it was very fortuitous, because Ajahn Sumedho wasn't at the meeting. He was here in America visiting his family. And so he was called down to L.A. where Master Hua was. He was on his deathbed, very ill. And Master Hua formally made the offering of 125 acres of forest land in Mendocino County, which is here. So there's two pieces of property where we are right now was a piece of property that after this was the it's on this side if we're looking up the hill, and what was Master Hua offered was sort of on this side, and then this it's very long and narrow. Both properties start at Tomkai and go up to the top of the ridge. And so this, and they're both about 125 acres. So then after the property was offered, then Sanghapala Foundation started thinking, well, you know, if we're going to invite monks, we should sort of see, I think it was the possibility of 1996, the next year, being an opportunity to invite the monks to come. And I think I might have already committed to coming by then. Was kind of the impetus as well for looking for land to that where, because what they needed was the land that Master Hua offered, there was no electricity, no water, no buildings. And they thought, well, if we rented a place nearby, then we could see if that land is developable.
I think you made the offer to Ajahn Amaro sometime in the summer of 95 or the fall, but it didn't become public until...
I made the offer to Ajahn Amaro in something like April
of
95. I was doing a year-long retreat in Chithurst Forest, and because I knew that this was happening, and I knew that this wasn't happening because it was Ajahn Amaro was designated, but it wasn't going forward, so I thought, well, maybe if I offer to help Ajahn Amaro, that'd be a support for him, because I've known him since he wandered in off the beaches from the south of Thailand to Wat Nanachat. So I've known him since he showed up at Wat Nanachat and became a Anagarika, a novice, a monk, and then known him over the years, and we always got along, so I figured it might be a good mix. But because I was in retreat at in England, and I wasn't going to be going back to Thailand till the fall, then I said, you know, you'll just have to wait until I get permission from the Sangha, Wat Pa Phong Sangha Wat Nana Chat, and see if it's okay for me to actually do it. My heart was in it, but I also had to think in terms of other people. So that was so Ajahn Amaro was privy to information that other people didn't know about. So sometimes I think it was he got criticized for being overly optimistic about doing anything here, and he remember him saying, he said, sometimes I could hardly keep my mouth shut. You know, I said, but I've got this ace in the hole. but anyway, so that that came to be, and then Sangha Paula went ahead and started looking for a rental property that they could have the monks come to. And then I think that was like in the winter of like late 95, early 96, because I had already gone sort of public that I was involved. And then, because I remember discussing with him in Thailand, and that this was a possible, it was like early 96, and negotiations were going on. But then what happened is they found that this property right here was being rented by somebody, so then they contacted the owner, see if it was possible to rent it. They weren't, and then the owner sort of said, "Well, I'm actually just." He was renting it, but then he said, "Well, I'm actually just drawing up the paperwork now to sell. So you can either buy it or forget it." And so they scrambled and were able to arrange for purchase. Of course, they didn't have any money, but Sangha Paula Foundation was rolling in dough in those days, ready to make real estate commit. They had $15,000 in the bank. So that's, which, even in those days, it wasn't much money. everything, there's lots of goodwill and lots of people helping from all sorts of, so that just that sense of, okay, they're reflecting on sort of the beginnings of Abhayagiri and the continuity of Abhayagiri. It relies on so many people, both say within the Sangha and within the greater community, helping out and giving support in so many different ways. And then they did arrange for the purchase and the date of the moving in was June the 1st. And yeah, so May 31st, they were still in the, and they spent a month or so in the city with the lay community, and then getting ready to move up, and then they were able to, and it just happened to be the night before was Visakha Puja, so the various lay people who were associated with Sangapala met together at Dr. Mark Lieberman's house in his shrine, big shrine room, and then Ajahn Amaro gave Ajahn Kurundamo the Anagarika precepts, and put him into white, and began his monastic career. And so Ajahn Kurundamo has been here since day one. And I showed up 6 months later. I mean, I had made a commitment to help, but then when I got back to Thailand and started passing on my duties and organizing things to leave. I mean, I'd spent 23 years in Thailand, so I'd put down far deeper roots than I realized, and it took me much longer to disentangle myself and do things in a beautiful way in order to leave smoothly and leave Wat Danachat in left in the good hands of Ajahn Jayasaro, and then with the blessings of the senior elders in Thailand. So it was an auspicious beginning, both say starting here, and then for myself when I came. I arrived in San Francisco New Year's Eve, beginning 1997, and started the new year to be helping out here at Abaya Giri. And so when I got here, they had just finished building a kuti to receive me. That was the lower Black Rock kuti, which those kutis were, there was five kutis built that first year. And they were kind of thrown up pretty quickly with scavenged materials and odds and ends, thinking that they would last for a few years, and then they could be replaced. Of course, it's only just this past year that the first one has been finally replaced, the log cabin. And it was, I mean, it was sort of, those were all logs that were found by a neighbor up the road. And they were kind of discarded by the loggers because they were a bit too small. So then we scavenged them, peeled them, and put them, got them stacked up and put it made into the walls. Of course, for the last many years, so if it were a day like today, with you know, the wind is blowing pretty, there's quite a wind today. If you're sitting inside the log cabin, yeah, you'd be having the wind blowing blowing through you. So that was it was ready to be replaced. And the other ones are Lower Black Rock and Upper Black Rock. Those are actually in quite good shape. They were fixed up a few years after. Well, we actually had to fix them up. The county required us to bring them up to some kind of a code and make them more acceptable to the building department, and so that they're still in good shape. And those will probably be the last two to come down. And the other two, the 8x8 and the 10x10, those are, hopefully those will, in the next year or two or three, those will get replaced and they're ready. But those early years, I was just thinking of, you guys moved in here, because this little house, old garage that, there's nothing very nice here. And was it Richard Smith who drove out from Michigan with a washing machine?
Yes, he did.
Yeah, we didn't have a washing machine, and he drove out to wash me. I don't know if he had a fridge.
He brought the dryer.
He brought the dryer.
Yeah, yeah.
You bought the. Jen Crudenell still had money as an anagarika, but the washing machine, and Richard Smith came out with it, offered the dryer, so brought it out. I think he brought some other appliance too. I have his memory. Paul Friedlander offered the fridge. I was thinking, we were just recently heard about something. Yeah, Paul Friedlander was one of the early people. He's been helping with Thanksgiving retreat like forever. So before Vaigiri.
Yeah.
So which is another sort of, this arc of people involved with that sense of wanting to see a Vaigiri be a place of refuge. Because that's what a Vaigiri, literally it means, abaya means fearless. Giri is mountain, so fearless mountain. But fearless in the sense of secure, safe, a place of safety, a place of security, a place where one does not have to dwell in fear, which is how, if you are a sentient being with any kind of a nervous system, you experience fear, and certainly as human beings and in the animal realm, one of the predominant emotions is fear, and it drives a lot of our conduct and our relationships, so that to be able to try to create a place there where people could come and they could put their fears down. That's a gift to the society, to the culture. And it's America, I mean any culture, any cluster of human beings together. Fear is a major component of life. But America in particular is definitely driven by fear. There's many reasons for that, many elements to it. Certainly the degree of competition that is part and parcel of the consumer culture. It drives, it's a fear-driven culture. And of course it's for a long time, it's had an undercurrent of violence the opposite or component of that is fear. So they're trying to provide a place of refuge, and that was one of the purposes of having, a Vaigiri as a namesake. There's also Ajahn Amaro he's a bit of a history buff, and history buff, polyglot, and polymath, and that sense of knowing that in, say, Buddhist history, in Sri Lanka, oh, about 1,000 years ago or so, there was a famous monastery in Sri Lanka that called Abhayagiri, and it was very large, thousands of monks, probably thousands of nuns as well, and that was it was a monastery that straddled different lineages and traditions. And was a practice tradition, very much a practice tradition. It's like for most traditional Buddhists that have heard of the Visuddhimagga, which is a commentarial manual on teachings and practice. But it is, has a very strong element of the. It's out of a monastery that was the Mahavihara in Sri Lanka, and it is a bit more of a. And still exists, I think. Scholarly tradition, and but the there's another book that was a manual of practice, Vimuttimagga, and it came out of Abhayagiri, and it was much more of a practice manual, a meditation manual. I mean, it was grounded in the teachings, but it had a bit more of a flavor of meditation and practice, mental training, than the theoretical aspects of the scholasticism. But that was Abhayagiri. It had that lineage. But also, what happened was there had been this back and forth over many centuries. And finally the king at that particular time in Sri Lanka decided that the Mahavihara, the other monastery, should have primacy, should be the prime. And Abhayagiri should not, so it was actually disbanded. The remnants are still there today. There's a huge, huge stupa that still exists today. I went a few years ago and paid respects at the Abhayagiri stupa. It's quite moving to see. But anyway, that sense of having a place of practice, having a place of refuge, And again, that's where it encompassed the different lineages. And because Master Hua made the offering, he's a Chinese Mahayana monk, it was a way of honoring him as well. So that we've had a very warm, close relationship with the City of 10,000 Buddhas since before Abhayagiri. Because Master Hua passed away in 1995, He passed away shortly after the offering of the land was made. And then, was it the last trip that Lumpa Sumedho was here? One of the last trips that Lumpa Sumedho was here, and he was because he's always invited to go give a talk at City of 10,000 Buddhas, and he always goes. He's extremely has a very warm feeling towards our community, and anyway, he went to give the talk, a formal Dhamma talk to the whole assembly, which is a big community, and is in the Buddha Hall, and they invited Lumpa Sumedho to sit in Master Hua's Dhamma seat. Nobody had sat in that seat since he passed away, and they invited Lumpa Sumedho to give the address the assembly from Master Hua's Dhamma seat. It was a very touching gesture, and again the sense of feeling of mutual respect and mutual appreciation and gratitude for each other. And I think that's one of the things in terms of say as a monastery, 25 years of Abhayagiri, it's not about, and should never be about, you know, how do we compete with these other people? How do we angle for advantage? You know, that's so just so wrong. But it's more like how can we be a part of this this human life and try to bring a place of refuge, a place of safety, a place of harmony and community into the world, and so that that's an ongoing project, and this 25 years of Abhayagiri, hopefully that continues for another 25 years anyway. In another 3-4 years, there'll be the 50th anniversary of Wat Banana Chat, the international monastery. Ajahn Chah established, and Lumpa Sumedho was the first abbot. I was there on the first year. There's a group, I think there's 11 of us altogether. I think nine monks, one novice, and one Anagarika. It's amazing to think, but it's, you know, all of a sudden, you know, time passes, and like 25 years, it seems like a long time, it's within many of our memories, and there'll be many of the community that are here, have been here since the beginning, but then who have also even be here before the establishing of Abhayagiri, and help to sort of facilitate that, to make it work. Yeah. So that time continues. It doesn't actually slow down and stop for anybody. And there will be people who will be. I remember When we were building this building, Lopaliam, the abbot of Wat Bapong, he was looking at the construction of it, and he's very observant, and he himself is a builder, he's looking at it, and he said, and then he's sort of after looking and watching the builders working away, and he said, at least 150 or 200 years. He said, okay, this is going to be here for a while. But I think it's, you know, in terms of the establishing, say, a Bhayagiri, honoring our elders, honoring our teachers. Lopa Sumedho was very, he was a catalyst for this to happen. And I remember one time being with Lopa Sumedho and Lopa Cha. We were at a branch monastery in Ubon in Thailand. And it was the first time that Ajahn Sumedho had come back from England to visit Thailand. Ajahn Cha made the comment, well, you know, you should really appreciate all that, say, Ajahn Sumedho has done. He's been the tank who has gone before all of you, sort of prepared the way for all the rest of you. So it's similar. This a Bhayagiri is very much. I mean, he went to England and established a sangha, first sangha in the West. And put down those roots and made that something that was accepted and viable and replicable, that, say, inspired lay people in the San Francisco Bay Area to want to have a place like that here in the Bay Area. So it's again, sort of the Lopa Sumedho being the kind of like the tank out in front of the everybody else, or the tractor that pushes the way, bulldozer that clears the way, and
I think he's actually the most senior American vicar in the world.
I'll bet he is.
Mr. Law said that.
Yes, so he's. Is the most senior American bhikkhu in the world. And gosh, these days he is, he's on fire with his teaching. No, he's teaching just about every week. And because he moved back to, he was away in Thailand for about 10 years and moved back to Amravati early this year, I think in January, I guess, and then, you know, getting acclimated, well, going through his quarantine and then getting acclimated and then slowly starting to teach. And now he's teaching on a quadra at least once a week these days, if not twice. It's quite wonderful to see, because on a certain level, you know, he's falling apart. He will be 87 Yeah, he'll be 87 this summer. We're 15 years apart. My birthday's the 26th of July, he's the 27th. So then, so he'll be 87. You know, he's got an 87-year-old body. hearing's not so good. Eyes are not good at all. His balance is not very good. But his heart is bright, brilliant. And his ability to articulate and point to the, and the essence of the, he's not talking a whole lot about, how do you say, the details. He's talking about kind of the essence of things, and it's very beautiful. Because he spent a whole lifetime laying the foundations of all the nuts and bolts and the details, and it's keeps just coming back to the essence of it, and just the, you know, the reality of you know, as our doorway into liberation is through the ability of the heart to just know and see clearly. That is, and of course it, you can talk about it, explain it, splice and dice it all these different ways, but the essence of it is just this quality of ability to know and see clearly, and to not get lost, not get entangled, not complicate things too much. Which is a tall order, because we're so adept at complicating. Living in a in a monastery like this, say Abhayagiri, again, it's, I say, a gift of security, safety, fearlessness. But in order to experience that, in order to embody that, one has to return to the knowing. One has to return to awareness. As soon as we start moving out and proliferating, then we start tripping ourselves up. And this is something that certainly in terms of, say, honoring our elders, honoring our teachers, Ajahn Chah is the inspiration for all of us. It might be a bit more difficult for people who are younger or more newly connected with our tradition. Ajahn Chah is the inspiration for Ajahn Sumedho to train, to live the holy life, to practice and to gain understanding of this path. As for myself, that was my inspiration to commit to Buddhist practice and particularly monastic training, that it was Ajahn Chah. There's something about him that inspired, not just inspired me, but inspired so many people, both Thai and Western, and they, he was a wonderful communicator. His ability to communicate and inspire and encourage people to practice and live the Dhamma, and oftentimes people would be amazed or confused as to how can saying to him, how can you teach these people, especially these Westerners who come from all around the world, or foreigners, because came from many, many different countries. And he said, it's just like, and the image, of course, is quite funny in Thai, and especially so, because he gives the image of teaching buffaloes, which buffaloes are the epitome of dullness in Thai culture, sort of that. So comparing was, it's just like teaching buffalo. He's teaching these Westerners. You can, if buffaloes can learn, I'm surely these Furongs can learn. So it's, because you don't have a common language with a buffalo. You can train it to do this, train it to that. You can have it be of help and service, and that's it. So Ajahn Chah said he was a master at bringing things down to a very simple, relatable terms, and again, a sense of not overly complicating things. He was able to really say, well, what is the essence? Not in an intellectual way, but in a direct knowing way. And of course, the essence is what the Buddha himself said over and over and over and over again, all through his 45 years of teaching. I teach only two things, dukkha and the ending of dukkha. And that's, it's easy to sort of look at the great compendium of the Buddha's teachings, and the commentaries and the Abhidhamma, and there's lots to know, lots to lots of explanations for everything. But the heart of it, the purpose of it, is that recognition of experience, and that as human beings, everybody wants to be happy, peaceful, at ease, comfortable, safe, free from dukkha, and the tools that the Buddha gives are for that purpose. And so that something like, let's say, Abhayagiri or any proper monastery, any good monastery, any good, say, meditation center, any good collective of human beings coming together, are that the purpose, dukkha and ending it, for knowing dukkha and knowing how to be free from dukkha, which its corollary is also knowing happiness and knowing how to realize happiness, knowing peace and knowing how to realize peace. That's its core. But the Buddha used dukkha as a because nobody wants to experience dukkha. Nobody gets up in the morning and, you know, as you're brushing your teeth and washing your face, you're sort of thinking, you know, how can I get more dukkha in my life today? And it's nobody thinks that. But it's the but we do it. That's how we live. We go on to autopilot and we just stumble our way through our life. So, but that's the whole purpose of practice, and a way of practice is to be able to realize a sense of understanding dukkha and understanding the freedom from dukkha. And that's something that Ajahn Chah over and over again. I mean, I lived with Ajahn Chah for so many years, and he gave many, many, many teachings, but he'd always come back to that point, because that's the rub, that's the experiential basis for exploring, investigating, practicing. And you have to bring it back to experience. It can't be about theory, ideals, speculation. It has to be about experience. So that, you know, 25 years of Abhayagiri and the support and encouragement from all of our teachers and elders over all this time, the support and encouragement from the all the lay community, from, well, I mean, just like today, Zoom gathering, and 17 countries are involved. I mean, it's wonderful, and you know, everybody is wishing us well. I mean, people don't, you know, again, you know, people don't make the effort to sign up to the Zoom and plug in, sort of, you know, say for looking for failure and finding fault. It's there. Everybody's wishing us well, and everybody's wishing each other well. And it's important to make it conscious. These are the sort of things we overlook or forget, and so that too, having occasions like this are a great opportunity for bringing it to mind, and then dedicating our practice for our own benefit and the benefit of others. That's something that it's a refrain that comes up over and over again through the Buddhist teachings, that one practices for, say, one's own welfare and happiness, and for the welfare and happiness of others. That's your thread that underlies our practice. So today is the first day of gathering, and I just delight in the fact that so many people are joining us, yeah, both physically and virtually, and it's an opportunity to practice together, and to listen to teachings together, reflect on teachings together, and to dedicate the blessings for everyone. So,